Hello and welcome to another episode in the Wolves Fancast series, Stories from the Pack. Ryan Hooper here with you for this episode. I'm delighted to be joined on this episode by primarily a Wolves fan, but to give him his working title, it's BBC Sport England editor Steve Marshall. Steve, how are you?
Hello, Roy. Yes, I'm very well, thank you. Not too bad at all.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Steve. We'll go through the episode in kind of an order of your initial Wolves story. But I know Wolves, in terms of your relationship with Wolves, has been both personal and professional. So we may look at that as well. But ultimately, with everybody that's on, whatever title or vocation that they do, we're all part of the pack, which is what the series is about. So if we start at the very beginning, if we can, see, when did your Wolves story begin in terms of your first either game or memory of being a Wolves fan?
Well, my first memory of being a Wolves fan came probably a year or so before I actually went to my first game. My aunt has been going since the 1950s, since the real glory days of Wolves. And back in the early 1980s, it was the 82-83 season, she used to drop my grandma off at our house at weekends on Saturday afternoons. So she stayed with my mum and dad and my sister and me while she went off to Molyneux to watch the games. And she used to bring me back a programme. And during that season, the first time I sort of got to know Wolves, if you like. Obviously, won promotion under Graham Hawkins and came second to Queen's Park Rangers, I think it was, if I remember rightly. But it was a team of sort of Mel Eaves and Andy Gray and Kenny Hibbett and John Burridge. So those names sort of became very familiar in the 82-83 season. And I was only sort of six or seven at the time. But that was what got me into the Wolves bug, really, was having those programmes come back from my aunt. And as it is, you know, she was the one who took me to my first game the season later in January 1984. It was a week after Wolves won at Anfield when Steve Marjoram got the only goal. And we played Luton at home and lost 2-1, predictably, given that team. John Pender scored the Wolves goal. I remember him heading in from a corner. And we sat in the John Ireland stand, so what's now the Steve Bull, when it was, you know, miles away from the pitch. Yeah. It was great. And just going in that first time, I was absolutely hooked. So that was great. And, you know, from there, I went to another game that season, which was the goalless draw with West Brom towards the end of the season when they got relegated, of course. And then from there, I sort of went steadily. I went steadily the following few seasons as Wolves went down and down the leagues. So, you know, even the triple relegation didn't put me off.
Brilliant. And I think then really your Wolves journey then started in a real interesting part of Wolves history, as you say. So I guess just prior to sort of you coming on board, you'd had the 80 League Cup and so forth. And then,
that's right, yeah.
as you say, you'd had those sort of years where it was transitional. And then perhaps at that point, you know, we didn't foresee sort of, you know, as you say, those relegations and so forth. So was it sort of that intrigue initially when you weren't going to the games, you'd got the programme, you looked at it, you were familiar with the names, and did you kind of went, think, when am I going to get to go? And, you know, use that anticipation building.
Yeah. I think it was very much that. It was, you know, just having this football club on my doorstep. And, well, I say on the doorstep, I've lived in Walsall all my life. So, you know, the Wolves aren't my local club. But they've been the club of my aunt's. As I say, she still goes now with me, and we got our season tickets together. And you know, as my mum was growing up, she used to take her to games as well. And my mum stopped going when she had me and my sister. So my aunt was the one who was going all the time. And it's sort of her I've got to blame for supporting Wolves. But do I blame her? Not one bit. I love it.
Brilliant. And yeah, in those days, then, as you say, that John Ireland stand. I spoke to a couple of people because I think for a lot of people, my introduction was the family enclosure, as it was, as you say, in the John Ireland stand as well, and those red seats and those games they used to have before kick-off, just between
stand, yeah.
Which emphasised how far you were away from things, and, you know, and it's kind of still there now in obviously a different format. But So you caught the bug early on. Do you remember sort of the atmosphere and your walk up to the game, or do you remember in those days sort of, you know, your sort of pre, was there a ritual at all, or was it sort of...
Well, I remember at the time my aunt used to, because she lived in Rugeley, she always used to drive up the Cannock Road and towards Wolverhampton. So as you were driving through, you know, past Bushbury and that way into town, you could always see the Tower of St Peter's, but you could also see the big four floodlights on the corners of the ground, and that was the one thing I remember. And she used to park in Cambridge Street. So then, as you walked up that last bit of Cannock Road towards where it meets the Stafford Road, mm-hmm. you then got the John Ireland stand bang in front of you, and of course you could see the old North Bank as well. And even though it was a ramshackle ground, obviously it had great character. And during those early years, having started off in the John Ireland stand, we then moved, and I stood a couple of games on the North Bank in that second season. I think it cost me 50p to get in as a sort of 7-year-old standing up. And then when the North Bank closed, we moved to the old South Bank, which was, you know, an enormous terrace. And you know, given that the crowds at the time were only 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, there was loads of space, and you could see the pitch really well. The facilities weren't the best, to be honest. So I can sort of smell the toilets now. But then gradually we ended up moving back to the John Ireland stand, and then as you say, it was the family enclosure. Then when I sort of started going regularly and had my first season ticket, sort of in the early 1990s.
And that South Bank that did, as you say, although, you know, in that era, you know, we didn't have the crowds. They were all en masse in that section, weren't they? I started slightly after that. I remember the Molyneux Rose stand, and then the Billy Wright as it is now, and that wasn't there. And then obviously the North Bank, as you say, was coming down. So it was the focus was the South Bank, wasn't it? And it was, you know, how steep it was and that character, and you can romanticise about it, and there's some smells which stay with you, I guess, don't they?
Absolutely. It was a remarkable place to watch the football, and you know, even though the team wasn't very good, and I couldn't tell you how many games I saw us losing that time, because the team wasn't great, but it was just going to the football. That was the thing that really got to me. It was going to watch live football at this ground, and that shared experience really with other people. It was fantastic.
And I think, see, that's just what resonates with everyone, and it's very topical, you know, at time of recording, although this isn't going to go out of date, unfortunately. Fans aren't, you know, able to attend, and it just really reinforces, you know, what magic is when we go. And hopefully, you know, we'll be there when it's safe to do so. But in those early years, as you say, perhaps the players weren't many stars within that, and it was the experience. But as your sort of Wars journey started, any players that stood out initially, or any sort of favourites that came to mind?
Yeah, well, my first favourite was Danny Craney, who obviously scored two goals in the 3-1 win at the Hawthorns in November 1983. And that Christmas, I got my first Wolves kit. And when Father Christmas left, you know, popped down the chimney and left it in the front room, the label said it was from Danny Craney, which absolutely made my Christmas. So Danny Craney was the first one, really. And then going through as the team sort of went down the leagues, I quite liked Andy King, who was the shining light of the Division 3 relegation season, scoring, you know, double figures from midfield. And then the following season, you know, obviously, before Bully came along, there was a guy up front called Neil Edwards, who they'd signed from Olds Winford for not a lot of money, who started that season really well, actually, with some goals, and then got injured and never saw him again, partly because we had a bloke by the name of Stephen George Bully who arrived on the scene and sort of did rather well over the years.
It's just iconic, isn't it? You know, well, it comes up, but there's no apologies for that either, really, because it is so iconic. And I think it's just, oh, Look, we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, and everybody listening to this will have seen or have got memories or been told, if for anyone younger, about Bully. But there was just something about Bully that I think there was a time when if you weren't in the game, you were never out of it because he was on the team sheet.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I was genuinely one of the lucky ones or unlucky ones, if you like, to be at his debut against Wrexham, which obviously a 3-0 home defeat with Bully wearing, I think, the number 8 shirt for the only time in his Wolves career, again in the John Ireland stand. And nobody watching that day would have foreseen the impact he went on to make for the club. But it was like, you know, once he got that first goal under his belt, he just became an absolute machine. And, you know, he and Andy Mutch were just far too good for those two levels. And it was quite a simple game plan, wasn't it? You know, it was sort of two banks of four, bang the ball up to Bull and Mutch and let them do the rest. And, you know, two successive seasons with 50-odd goals, you know, two titles, a Wembley final as well in the Sherpa van against Burnley in 88. It was, you know, as a Wolves fan growing up at that time, having had the really lean years of those three successive relegations and seeing everybody at school at the time, you know, nobody, I, you know, we've been in Warsaw, nobody supported Wolves. It was all Villa, it was all Liverpool. There was even more Warsaw fans at my junior school than Wolves fans. So I was the only one there in a Wolves shirt and when it came to games and PE and stuff. But I wouldn't have had it any other way.
And as you say, it's part of the journey, really. And what we always look at, and there'll be many moments within your supporting Wolves where there's been highs or lows. We'll start with the low because we'll end the section on a positive. So was there a particular moment that stands out or name a couple, if you may, Steve? We won't go into too much detail, but I think it makes you, in a very cheesy way, appreciate perhaps what we've got now and those highs. But a tough time supporting Wolves, what stands out for you?
Do you know what? I think the toughest, you know, you can throw in playoff defeats and you can throw in, you know, I could easily pick a playoff defeat, or I could throw in the FA Cup semi-final against Watford a couple of years ago, which probably is right up there. But I think in my Wolves journey, actually, the lowest I've ever been is probably, it was December 2012 when Solbakken was in charge, and we'd been beaten by Peterborough on Boxing Day. And then Ipswich came to town. So it's Mick McCarthy's first game back at Molineux. And we lost 2-0. And I'd take my wife's sister's married to a Frenchman. So and they've got four boys. And they came over for Christmas last year. And whenever they come over for Christmas, they want to go to a football game. Mm-hmm. So I'd taken them to Wolves against Ipswich. And not only were we terrible, and I can't remember a more abject Wolves performance. Really, it was just we offered absolutely nothing. And the reason I pick it as my sort of real low moment is it's the only time I can ever coming out of the ground saying the manager has got to go, because I just didn't see any plan, and the players didn't seem to be playing for him. It was just absolutely insipid. You know, it didn't get much better that season, but you know, I think that would, as something a bit different, I think I would put that as one of the low moments. As I say, picking a playoff final, playoff semi-final defeat, or Watford was a low point as well, and probably particularly Watford, because, you know, we were so close to doing something really, really special that year. But I could forgive that team. I could forgive mm-hmm. the team that, because they'd given us such a magical 2 years before in winning the championship, and then, you know, taking the Premier League by storm like we did in that first year, that, you know, for all the disappointment of losing to Watford at Wembley, having been two goals up and so close, I could forgive them that. But that performance under Solbakken was just, it's just terrible, absolutely terrible.
And I think that's the thing, though, because, you know, we will have people will mention you to say your Bolt and your Palace and so forth. But I think it's not, and the Watford one was disappointed at the time, of course, but the bigger picture was there, wasn't it? I guess
absolutely, with, you know, yeah.
The Watford one, and yeah. The way I saw the Watford one, I was disappointed. It was great because I got to go with my dad, and we don't do it as much as we should, and that was lovely, and it was a great personal moment for me. But I kind of thought, well, we'll be here again. Well, I didn't know what was coming to be able physically to be there again, but, you know, again, being positive, well, hopefully we'll soon. But in terms of where the club was, it kind of felt as if, okay, well, we're on a good progression and this is a blip in the road. But I guess what you're saying, Steve, with that sell back and point, it was like, well, are we at a crossroads here? Where do we go from here? Because this is, you know.
Absolutely. Like, and as I say, just the fact it's the only time I can ever recall coming out of Molineux and thinking the manager's got to go. You know, we've been obviously been through managers before with, you know, Graham Turner and Graham Taylor and, you know, Mick McCarthy and Glenn Hoddle and Dave Jones and all those, but I don't think ever, I can't recall ever as a fan myself, you know, people might say, well, he's clearly a happy clapper if he doesn't want the manager to go over, but it's probably not like that. But it was the only time where I actually felt that the manager had completely lost the plot and I couldn't see any way out of it. It was just so bad.
Yeah, no, it was a tough time, and it was a strange time as well. And I think we started okay, didn't we, under Solbakken? And if I remember, we seemed
we did.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then
that's right. We won at Blackburn in early October to go second or third, and then it all nosedived. I mean, that period was also quite a difficult sort of time for me personally as well, because my daughter had been born the year before. She was 14 weeks premature, so sort of, you know, that relegation from the Premier League the season before, when McCarthy got sacked and Terry Connor came in, sort of passed me by a little bit because I'd got other things on my plate. Yeah. And sort of that's by sort of Christmas of that year, I was just starting to get back to sort of going to games a bit, because, you know, everything was okay at home, and to just see the team, it was just an absolute rabble. And of course it didn't get any better under Dean Saunders either, did it?
No, God, no. I mean, it was a tough to watch with Saunders. I remember Solbakken calling Steve, and there was a bit of expectation, and I kind of thought, well, he's a little bit different, we hadn't really gone for a European manager before. And I remember going to a Q&A he did, and he spoke very well, very articulate. And I was like, okay, he's charmed me. But his football didn't ultimately, unfortunately, as you say. So that was the sort of Solbakken era and a tough time. And I think, as you say, with football as well, it is the off the field as well, in terms of where you're at as well. It takes you back to a time, doesn't it, as well. But moving on now to better times, a moment or moments for you where you've either thought, wow, it doesn't get any better than this, or was a particular game or a feeling where you thought, what? You know.
I was thinking about this, and I could cherry pick so many games from over the years of you know, really magic moments I've been lucky enough to be at, you know, from the Sherpa van final in 1988 to the winning the fourth and third divisions in those seasons. My first away game that I went to was the 4-2 win at West Brom. So that's, you know, that's really clearly up there as well. But I think in terms of games, then sort of I can't think of anything better at Molineux than that Manchester United FA Cup quarter final. I've just never heard Molineux like it. It was absolutely feral. I mean, I've always been somebody who loves going to evening games and football under the lights. There's always been something really magical about that. I'd always much rather go to an evening midweek game than a 3 o'clock on a Saturday, if I'm being honest. I just think there's a better atmosphere about it. But, you know, that was like a perfect storm, wasn't it? It was a Saturday night under the lights in front of the BBC TV cameras. And as I say, I don't ever recall Molineux being as loud as that when Jota's goal went in. But in terms of best moments overall, I think that 10 minutes before that opening Europa League game against Crusaders last year was really hard to beat. It was a real lump in the throat moment for me. You know, having you know, started out with three successive relegations and sort of stayed on the bandwagon, if you like, to see Wolves competing in Europe was just something I never thought would happen. You know, that wasn't meant to happen, being a Wolves fan. You know, the closest we got to Europe was the Anglo-Italian Cup in the 1990s. And to, you know, I know it was against, you know, relative minnows from Northern Ireland, but that, yeah, you know, just to see all that colour, all that gold that night at the Parc Molineux on a really hot, sweaty night, it was a real lump in the throat moment. And that's why sort of those European nights from last season mean so much to me. And it's partly why I'm not really enjoying football at the moment, because we're not there. We're having to watch from the TV. I mean, last night, for example, after the final whistle, I didn't really feel bothered. We'd lost 3-1. You know, Manchester City were excellent in the first half. We weren't that good. We played really well second half. And I thought we had the chances to get something out of the game. But it's just the fact we're not there at the moment that sort of hurts as a football fan. Because for me, it's all about that collective experience and being there in the stadium rather than watching it off TV.
And I think that's the thing. And this is one of the reasons why, I was into this series, because I do think, and I'm not being romantic here, or maybe I am, and that's fine if I am, because I'm, again, everyone listening will feel the same. There is something, and there's a raw emotion, and it doesn't matter if you support Wolves, whoever you support, about going, the whole experience. And, you mentioned in terms of going to the game, the side wasn't great. And it, in some ways, in those early days, I don't know if it was like what it was like for you, Steve, the result, I wouldn't say irrelevant, but it was more about the going. And I think that's kind of how it feels. And yeah, I mean, I can really relate to that. But as you say, Wolves in Europe. And I think for those who perhaps a little bit younger, not to remember the Anglo-Italian Cup. So that was a competition between the Championship and Serie B, wasn't it, I think, at the time?
That's right, yeah. I mean, that's correct, yes.
Port Vale used to do quite well in Stoke. And that was a
business. And we didn't.
Yeah, that one seriously. And it died there. So as you say, for many generations, that was our experience of Europe, or a pre-season friendly against a mid-table Spanish side. So it's just the whole experience of being in Europe. And those games as well, any games from Europe that stood out for you? Obviously for the occasion, I guess, the Crusaders games, but any of the sort of the away games that sort of stood out for you?
I didn't manage to get to any of the away games because my wife was poorly with pneumonia from sort of November onwards. So I ended up missing sort of Besiktas and Espanyol as well, unfortunately, because I've got childcare duties to do. But, even that first game in the group against Braga, it just felt a massive milestone to be there. Even though we didn't play that well and we didn't win, it didn't really matter. It was sort of being there. But, I'd have loved to have got soaked in Braga. The one trip I'd have really liked to have done was the Bratislava one, just for the Eastern European culture, really. Obviously it was just a game where loads of school kids got to go to, and that was about it. Even following those on TV and local radio last year was great fun, and I can remember leaping around the kitchen like a loony when Willie Bolly stuck that late winner in Besiktas.
I think that was the key for me. I think, and that week, if you remember it, so we beat Besiktas and then we went and beat Man City. And yeah. I was just like, to have that conversation within a week, and we were doing the podcast at the time, and I was asked to talk about it. I said, okay, so I've just got, let me get this agenda right. We just beat the Besiktas and then we just beat Man City. And it's like, it's sort of a pinch me moment, and it's not that we don't deserve to, because anybody that's watched this side over the last few years, we deserve to be there. But you do have those bizarre moments where you have a bit of a chuckle to yourself because of the journey that we've been on as fans. And Steve, before we sort of talk about what it means for you to be a fan and part of the pack, now, during your relationship with Wolves, it took a professional angle at a time. So you were previously correspondents for the Express and Star with the Wolves. How did that come about, and how was that experience as a fan moving into that at that time?
Well, sports journalism was always something I wanted to get into. And I was very lucky to have done several years as a news reporter. But I always wanted to get into sports. And in my spare time, I sort of did a little bit of sport reporting of the non-league football. I did Birmingham a few times, and I helped out with a couple of Wolves games as well. So, I was lucky enough, for example, to be at the first Premiership game at Blackburn in 2003. Although again, the result wasn't great, with Tim Nash, who I ended up taking over from. But I ended up joining the Express and Star Sports desk in sort of November 2006, I think it was. Yeah, to November 2006. Sorry, I'm getting my dates wrong. It was November 2004. Mm-hmm. And I'd moved to the sports desk to become, to take over doing the covering Kidderminster Harriers in place of Malcolm Cinnamond, who'd become a sub-editor and was moving away to Orkney. So I started off covering Kidderminster for three quarters of a season, and then somewhat out of the blue that summer, after we'd been relegated from the Premiership under Dave Jones, they decided to have a switch around at the Express and Star and gave me the Wolves job, which was a massive honour. I mean, you know, to be a Wolves fan, getting that job and following in the footsteps of not only Nashie but Dave Instone beforehand. Yeah, who I'd grown up reading as a kid was has been a huge mentor for me during my career. I mean, the help he gave me in sort of my pre-journalism days around work experience and stuff was invaluable. And then Mark, working with Martin Swain as well as someone to learn from was outstanding. And I've got a huge amount to thank both of them for. But it was a bit of a baptism of fire, because about a week later after I started the job, so we switched over in pre-season, and in fact, I think they just started return to training. About a week later, I was jetting off to Norway for the pre-season tour. So, as I say, it was a real baptism of fire, because, you know, I had no contacts at Wolves whatsoever. Mm. And there I am, sort of covering the tour, trying to get to know the staff, trying to get to know people within the club, and you know, it takes time to generate contacts. And I think if you look at how the way that sort of Tim Spears has developed in the job over the past few years, the fact he's grown into it over 4, 5, 6 years now, and the job he's doing in the Athletic is outstanding. I think it just shows that having that time to develop helps. And at the time, the management of the Express and Star like to change things around quite often, so you could never get your feet under the table properly. And I remember at the time, you know, I was massively proud to do it. But I think looking back at my career now, would I do a better job of it now than I did then? Undoubtedly. And it was probably a job too early, if you like, because I'd only done 8 months on Kidderminster Harriers. But to cover Wolves for those two seasons was brilliant. But I just felt that I was starting to really develop those contacts and get to know those people. At the time, I then moved on to doing another job, covering West Brom, as it happened, and Mark Douglas took over. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was a real honour to do, and there was some great memories. I mean, one of the first game I covered for Wolves was pre-season friendly at Tromso, and Wolves were great with me for that trip. And that myself and Dave Bagnall travelled with the team. The first night we arrived in Tromso, Stuart Gray and Dave Jones said, "Do you want to come out for a beer?" So he went out for a beer with him. John Hendley, obviously, you know, very sadly we've lost him over the past couple of years. He was just brilliant with me. He took me under his wing, looked after me. It was great company. And the first game we travelled to was Tromso. They didn't play in Tromso itself. They played on an island some way away. So we had to fly to the game.
Wow.
And the main squad who were playing travelled on a you know, what you call a proper plane, you know, a proper jet, and there was four of us left over. There was me, Foz, there was Jolyon Lescott and George Undar, and we were given a tiny little plane to go in. Obviously there was a pilot, which helped.
Yeah.
But it was, in comparison, it was like it was just a really small executive plane rather than a big proper jet. And Foz hated flying. He was there with his hands gripped on the seats. Is it all right? Are you going to be okay? And then at the back, because as we came into land where the game was being played, there was a bit of turbulence, and Foz was hanging on grimly to his seat. And then at the back, George and Dar pipes up, oh my God, we're going to die. as it is, it all worked out fine. But yeah, that was my first experience of covering Wolves, and Wolves went on to win the game that day. They won 3-2. Vio Ganea got a couple, looked really sharp in that pre-season. Morten Gamst Pedersen, who went on to have a great career at Blackburn, played for Tromsø that day and was their standout player. But yeah, Vio Guinea looked so sharp, and sadly, a couple of games later, when they played the third friendly in Oslo, he did his cruciate, and they obviously Wolves never really recovered then. I mean, it's just another story. A couple of months later, obviously Dave Jones was under increasing pressure, and Wolves had lost at Gillingham. They'd sort of picked up a little bit. They'd won at Plymouth, they'd won at Brighton, and they went on another bit of a dip. And they went and lost at Gillingham when they'd played against 10 men for more than half a game. And yeah, they really should have won. And the following day was the Midlands Football Writers annual dinner in Birmingham. And Rick Haywood, who was obviously Wolves chairman, was there at the time. And he was the sort of guest speaker. So anyway, I sort of made it my mission to try and speak to Rick afterwards. And not only did I speak to him afterwards, I ended up sharing a taxi back to Wolverhampton with him. and he was talking, you could tell from what he was saying that, you know, he wasn't sure whether Dave should be sacked or not. I think he was veering on the fact that he should have kept the job and it would turn out right. So I went to bed that night thinking sort of nothing more of it. And of course, the following day he got sacked because, you know, Rick had got back to the apartment at Molyneux. And when he got back, he'd spoken to Sir Jack, who'd told him to fire Dave. And the following day he'd gone. But yeah, Rick was a bit of a tortured soul in that taxi. But yeah, that was good fun. In terms of sort of proudest moments of my time covering Wolves, Rye, then I think my last day covering Wolves, or my last week, was probably as proud as I could get, because I sort of went out on something of a high, because my last big story I broke on Wolves was Mick McCarthy becoming manager, and Martin Swain and I were both. We were both chasing this story, and we both got it from different sources. And I managed to get hold of Mick's number from a contact up in the northeast, and tried it. And so he answered the phone, first of all. So I said, Mick, it's Steve Marshall from Express and Star here. I hear you're getting the Wolves job. Can you tell me any more about it? And he did the old, hello, I can't hear you trick, and hung up. So I then phoned him back, and it just went dead. It was clearly, it had a foreign ringtone before. So that was enough for us to run the story that Nick was going to get a job. And the following day, he was given it. So then my last day covering Wolves was the Saturday, so the day after Wolves had appointed him. And I was on the Saturday shift. I was the only reporter working the Saturday. I'd already got an exclusive with Paul Ince, because Paul was absolutely golden with us during his time at Wolves, and particularly me and Paul Berry. You know, bearing in mind who he was, then as two young reporters, we couldn't have asked for somebody better to deal with. But anyway, I tried Mick again on the Saturday morning, and it said a lot about the man that not only did he answer, but he apologised for the fact that he'd had to hang up so abruptly when he'd actually picked up the phone a couple of days before, and then gave me the first interview with him as Wolves manager. So to have him and Paul Ince on the same day, both exclusive on the last day of me covering Wolves, was a good way to go out.
That's brilliant. There's some brilliant stuff there from Rick Haywood, who I'd never met or certainly never shared a taxi with, as you have, but I heard so much about he's being a bit of an eccentric and, you know, his sort of larger-than-life personality. And then Mick is, someone who will always be very popular and ins, and that plane. Just imagine you've got some precious cargo in that plane going out.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you've got a defender in there who ended up leaving for what, £5-6 million to Everton, and good, you know, what would Joe Lescott be worth these days?
Brilliant. And then in terms of to close, Steve, the series is stories from the pack, and really what this is all about is what it means to you to be part of the pack. You've touched on it really eloquently, and we're really grateful. But just to summarise what it means to you to be part of the Wolves pack.
Oh, it's a massive privilege to be part of the Wolves pack. I have to say, I've loved every minute of going to watch Wolves since I started going in 1984. You know, even in those dark days when I remember standing on the north, the south bank when, you know, 4-0 down at half time and they're going to throw John Purdy on, and there's me being Mr. Optimistic thinking that John Purdy's going to turn the game around against Brentford when the game's gone. And just to have been on that journey over the past few years to, you know, all those years in the Championship, and now to see the team we have, we're so lucky to have this team we have at the moment. You know, we won't win every week, and you know, people were disappointed by that because inevitably people are disappointed when they lose. But what I just say is enjoy this team at the moment, because some of the players we have are just absolutely mind-blowing compared to some of the players who pulled on that shirt in the 1980s in particular. It's about that shared experience. It's about, you know, being able to hug that complete stranger who you've never hugged before. You know, when a last-minute goal goes in, yeah, that complete delirium. Going back to Wembley, you know, I had the Watford game, I had a young lad sitting behind me, and it wasn't Richard Hobbs, although Richard Hobbs was sitting behind me at Wembley. but he was a couple of seats along. But I'd got a young lad sitting next, right behind me, and I was checking he could see the game all the way through, because you know you don't want to stop enjoying that. And I just remember turning around when Jimenez stuck the second goal in, and the smile on his face was something that'll live with me forever. And we high fived, and it was just brilliant. So that's it's those moments that mean the most. And for me, it's as I say, it's family as well. You know, I still go with my aunt. My mum and dad have got season tickets, a couple of seats along in the Steeple stand as well. And I know they're all really missing it. So you know, hopefully, in the not too distant future, we'll be able to get back to doing what we love and setting foot in Molineux.
Brilliant. And just on that, really, you know, I hope for everyone that's listening, you know, in this time where going to games is on pause, what we're discussing now brings back some good memories, and there'll be memories that Steve's gone through and we've shared today that will mean something to someone there, and perhaps games and eras that will be new to others as well. So just before we close, a massive thank you to everybody who continues to support the podcast. And we've got loads going on with the podcast at the moment. We're doing the regular pods where we'll do a reaction after each game. We've also got, obviously, the stories of the pack, which we're on now. And also we've got the Alternative Hall of Fame and the film cast as well. So if you enjoy what we do, we'd love for you to leave a 5-star review. And myself and Steve, just finally, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, really enjoyed it.
Thank you, and we'll see you soon.